Shalom and welcome to the ICEJ webinar series. I'm your host today, David Parsons, Senior Vice President at the International Christian Embassy in Jerusalem, coming to you from our headquarters in the capital city of Israel. And today we're talking about the impact of the return of President Donald Trump to the White House for a second term, the impact it will have on Israel and the Middle East, and especially this multi-front war that Israel's been locked in for more than a year. And to help us sort this all out, I'm very happy, even giddy, to have my friend Michael Oren, the former Israeli ambassador to Washington, with us. It's good to have you, Michael.
Great to be with you, David, as always.
Okay, a little more background on him. Many of you probably know something about him, but he's an author and historian, written books on the Six-Day War, Power, Faith, and Fantasy about American engagement in the Middle East, his memoirs as Israel's ambassador to the U.S., simply entitled Ally. Plus, he's written children's books, lectured at Harvard, Yale, Georgetown, Hebrew U, Bar Ilan University here in Israel, a former Knesset member, deputy minister for diplomacy. And Michael, it says here on your bio update, founder of Israel Advocacy Group and author of the Substack Clarity. Substack must be the place to be these days.
It is the place to be these days. It's doing very well. We've got about 150,000 readers on this. It's hard-hitting truths about Israel and the Middle East.
Probably a more serious audience, yes. First of all, I am completely, thoroughly, absolutely relieved that we're not talking about a Kamala Harris presidency and the impact that would have on Israel and the region. Any comments on that to start with?
Yeah, the one is that I can't have a comment. You know, in my field, they say that no comment is also a comment. So I'll say no comment. But in my job, and I remain very much active diplomatically, politically, I have to remain scrupulously nonpartisan and bipartisan.
Okay,
so we'll forego the answer, but I'll be happy to talk about the ramifications of the second Trump administration on Israel, the Middle East, and I think the world.
That's right. We won't deal with hypotheticals anymore. We'll deal with the reality of Trump returning to office. And on this point, let's start with, at the top, the personal relationship between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel. It needed some repair. Is it repaired as of now?
Okay, so it's had ups and downs, as you mentioned. It was one time very close, then not close. The former president was angry at the prime minister for a number of reasons. We don't have to go into all of them. They seem to have made up. They're talking frequently now, and they're in a good place. Mm-hmm. Having said all that, Netanyahu cannot interact with President Trump the way he interacted with President Biden or President Obama before him. It's not that type of the adversarial relationship all the time. You know, for example, Netanyahu went to, in 2015, gave a speech to the joint session of Congress, basically behind President Obama's back, and he was very upset about this. President Biden said, don't go into Rafah in the Gaza Strip. Don't send your army into Lebanon. Do not bomb Beirut. And Netanyahu just said, I'm sorry. We're going to go ahead and do it. And thankfully, he did. I don't think you can do that with Donald Trump. I think that your latitude is much more restricted. You have to work with him. You can't work around him. And it's very important you don't lose his trust. And we have to interact with him with a tremendous amount of transparency, with candor, with respect.
But it should be a little friendlier atmosphere between them and talking things out beforehand, because let's face it, Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, actually called for Bibi to be removed, and Schumer's got the air of Biden, and it probably wouldn't have made that call without some nod from him.
I think that not just the president, but his team. His team is, from Israeli perspective, they're calling it the dream team here, and I think there's a good reason for it. I know most of them. Marco Rubio, Mike Waltz is the national security advisor. Rubio is the secretary of state. They haven't been affirmed yet by the Senate, but let's assume that that's going to be the lead team. Our good friend Mike Huckabee as the ambassador here, and Elise Stefanik as the ambassador to the United Nations, a former student of mine, David, by the way, and she's the
Yes.
greatest. As you couldn't get any better than this. Really, you couldn't get any better than this. So, but keep in mind, and I have to issue a caveat here, and it's this: all of these exceptional individuals, and I think that their support for Israel is unquestioned. They don't make policy; they carry out policy. At the end of the day, there's one person and one person only who makes the policy, and he is sitting in the Oval Office. And it's important for Israelis to understand what that policy is, to the degree that we can so far, certainly based on the previous Trump presidency, and make sure we don't take him for granted, and make sure we don't try to dictate policy to him. I think that would be a big mistake.
Going through this list of the dream team again, Senator Marco Rubio from Florida, he's been nominated to be Secretary of State. I saw a video where he said that all the deaths in Gaza, you can quote me on it, they're all laid at the hands of Hamas. I mean, he's very
100%
strong.
Hamas, he said. 100% Hamas. Great, a great video. He
Yeah.
was accosted by a pro-Palestinian protester. He said, "What do you
Yes.
think about all the people being killed?" So I'll tell you what I think. 100% Hamas.
Yeah. And Mike Waltz, can you tell us a little more about him? He's going to be National Security Advisor, which is really, really key, sitting in the White House with the ear of the president every day.
He's also an outspoken supporter of the state of Israel. And support of our right to defend ourselves, particularly against the Iranian threat, and more specifically, too, spill against the Iranian nuclear threat.
Yeah, so he's a real hawk on Iran.
Yep, they all are, actually. They all are, to a man and to a woman. So, from Israel's perspective, it really couldn't get any better. But I'm going to go back and say again, let's not jump the gun. Let's not literally jump the gun on this. Now, we have to look back at the first Trump administration. So this was, in terms of its record, the most presidents going back to Nixon and Johnson in the 60s and the 70s. Why was this so exceptional? Well, for the first time since 1948, a president recognized where you're sitting, Jerusalem, as our unified, undivided capital of the state of Israel. He recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. He withdrew from the horrendous, Israel can't make peace with any Arab country until it first creates a Palestinian state. Remember Secretary of State John Kerry saying, no, that's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. Well, guess what? Under President Trump, it happened. It happened. And Israel signed peace treaties with four Arab states, UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. And these are really upended the whole idea of peacemaking in the Middle East, because before you made peace with the government, you didn't make peace with the people. We have peace with Jordan. We have peace with Egypt. We don't have peace with the Jordanian people. We don't have peace with the Egyptian people. This is a completely different approach. We have peace with these peoples now, and we have normalization, something that has not happened, in 45 years since the signing of the peace between Egypt and Israel. So that was very significant. But there were all these other steps, David. He closed the PLO embassy in Washington. He withdrew funding from the terror-supporting UNRWA organization. He did so many things. But remember, when it came to annexing part of Judea and Samaria by Israel, he opposed it. He opposed unlimited settlement building in Judea and Samaria. He signed onto a peace agreement, a peace plan, and I helped was one of the advisors on that plan, that basically was a two-states plan. And Prime Minister Netanyahu signed on it, but a lot of the leaders in Judea and Samaria did not sign on it. And I don't know what he's thinking now. Nobody really knows just yet. But that peace plan is there, and there was an article, a big article by Thomas Friedman, the New York Times today, who is now, as I say, a friend, neither of Donald Trump nor Benjamin Netanyahu, and are expensive. He's a businessman, and he wants us to put an end to our wars, both in Lebanon and in Gaza. And what that means so far, at least the public, I can't know what the conversations have gone on between Netanyahu and Trump. We don't know what that means. But it means that in another 2 months, we should be wrapping it up.
When you just did a piece on the Times of Israel blog where it was mainly hitting on the media and their refusal to say Judea and Samaria and to follow that Jerusalem's the capital of Israel now. But you listed some of the policy decisions that were very pro-Israel of the Trump first administration, and how Biden reversed some but didn't others. He accepted the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, but he wanted to reopen the Palestinian consulate. And among these, there's not much for Trump to have to redo. I mean, he's got to cut off funding if he wants to UNRWA again, cut off funding to the Palestinian Authority. You think he'll do that?
I would expect Stefanik will once again withdraw America's ambassador from the UN Human Rights Council. And we mentioned this in the article. Now, the UN Human Rights Council condemns Israel for human rights violation more frequently than all of the countries in the world combined. That's North Korea, Iran, Russia, China. And it's only in the UN Human Rights Council that there's Article 7 of its charter, which actually mandates that the Human Rights Council investigate Israel, only Israel, every year for human rights violations. So George Bush Jr., back earlier in the century, withdrew America's ambassador from the Human Rights Council with the explanation that this is basically an anti-Semitic body. And the presence of a U.S. ambassador there simply lends legitimacy to an anti-Semitic body. Well, along comes Barack Obama and puts the ambassador back. Donald Trump comes in, takes the ambassador out, and of course, Biden put it back in again. So my guess is that ambassador is not going to be sitting there. I have a personal opinion that I've been espousing for years now, and I would hope that Donald Trump would follow up on it, and that is that they should kick the UN out of New York entirely, because it is a patently anti-Semitic body. It is corrupt. It has no place in a city which is, you know, the heartland of America's certainly finance and arts and home to one of the largest Jewish communities in the world. So let it go to a place, let the UN relocate to a place that's more, how should I say, more in line with its thinking. You know, it'd be very good UN headquarters in Damascus, US headquarters in Tehran, maybe Moscow. So that's just been my opinion for a long time. I don't know if he's going to do that.
Have you openly called for that?
Yes, I have many times. Going back, many times. I also in Jerusalem. I don't understand why, you know, in Jerusalem, up on Government Hill, okay, our Monon Etziv Hill, that beautiful building. That's where the British High Commissioner used to sit. The UN is there. You know what it's doing up there, David? The UNTSO. You ever see license plate that say UNTSO?
They live in my neighborhood. They monitor the Rhodes Armistice Agreement from 1949, and it's a total waste of time.
They're doing a great job. Yeah. Total waste. Great. They're doing a terrific job. And UN peacekeepers generally only work when there's no peace to keep. The minute they have peace to keep, they pull out. Or they're kicked out. So you know, it is a huge waste of money, and it actually serves, as we now know, UNIFIL actually protected Hezbollah for years and years, and let them to dig massive tunnels that they're going to use to invade Israel and massacre thousands of Israelis right under the nose of UNIFIL. No one can say they didn't know about it. So this is not a friendly organization, and I think the United States is treated like that. I'm sure that Ambassador Stefanik will view the UN not as an asset, but as a challenge and a potential threat.
If you want to drain the swamp, it's not just Washington, it's New York, the East River. East River.
Yes, sure.
Okay. Look, getting to the heart of our topic today, it was a surprisingly solid victory by Trump, sweeping all the swing states, even winning the popular vote, which really gives him a mandate. You don't have months and months, even years, of questioning Trump's legitimacy again. And it seemed to send a message to the region already. There's already an impact. I think you mentioned that the Iranian regime promptly told their team was no longer planning to attack Israel. We're talking about a retaliation for the retaliation for the retaliation, and said they were willing to negotiate with Trump. That seems like a quick impact right there.
Boy, was it? Boy, it was very profound, very profound. It hasn't been that profound in the American press. Okay, so I mentioned that the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post still refer to the Golan Heights as Israeli occupied or Israeli controlled Golan Heights. Basically, they're saying the democratically elected president of the United States actually doesn't determine foreign policy. We do. And think about what that means for American democracy when these papers of record simply run roughshod over American law. And it's quite startling. I couldn't believe that when I read it, but of course I could believe it. And so I wrote about it. And the important thing is that there will be many attempts to either reverse or undermine or ignore this president's policies toward the Middle East, because they won't be in accordance with, the policies of the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are pretty much the apology, the positions of the UN and of Belgium. And so that is a real challenge. And how do we meet that challenge? So one of the ways I said we meet the challenge is by, for example, if President Trump recognizes Israeli sovereignty on the Golan Heights, let's move 100,000 Israelis up to the Golan Heights in the next 4 years and create a rally there. When Trump recognized the Golan Heights as part of Israel, the prime minister unveiled a new settlement, a new town called Trump Heights, but there's no one living there. And so we actually have to act. If the president's going to do this for us, we have to meet him halfway. The president may also ask us to do some very hard things, David. I think he really wants a peace treaty between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis want us to discuss a pathway to a Palestinian state. Now, they always say that word, pathway. They don't want to discuss a Palestinian state, but a pathway. The Saudis are smart, David. They know that if a Palestinian state were created in Judea and Samaria, and that state would fall to Hamas in a matter of days, that state would take down Jordan, it would take down half the Gulf, and be a tremendous asset to Iran. They're not foolish. They know what they're talking about. But they do have a public opinion. They're not a democratic state, but they do have public opinion, and they have to assuage that public opinion by saying, okay, we're talking about this state. And it needs Israel to do that. Now, Israel's current government will find that very, very difficult. And so President Trump, I'm not a prophet, but this is what I foresee coming, will say to Netanyahu, will say to Prime Minister Netanyahu, you're going to have to discuss this. Tell your government I'm demanding it. If they don't like it, go to elections. And because I want that peace treaty. And by the way, so do we.
I think Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi leader, first of all, he said that he's not so interested in a Palestinian state, but his people are. Therefore, he has to sort of follow
Sure.
that course. But isn't his priority a defense pact with the U.S., and he would be willing to make some compromises on the elements impacting Israel?
Think he would, but I think there are certain limits to it. Listen, he also wants nuclear power. Predicted that Israel would soon, because the United States was offering nuclear power to the Saudis. And I said that anybody thinks that the Iranians are going to sit quietly while the Saudis get nuclear power, they're kidding themselves, that the Iranians will try to start a small war. I was wrong on the small war. But they certainly were behind in supporting this war, and they wanted to stop that peace treaty. They did stop the peace treaty. But once it comes up again, and the nuclear power is part of the package, Iran will do everything to try to stop it.
And of course, the big bogeyman, Iran, if the U.S., if Trump makes a deal with the Saudis, it helps protect them from the Iranian threat. That has to be a big incentive. And it looks like the Saudis have waited. They waited out the Biden administration because they think they can get a better deal on under Trump.
Yeah, but I also think that Trump would, I wouldn't rule out the possibility that President Trump will negotiate with the Iranians. Now, he expressed an interest in negotiating with them during his first term, but he wants to negotiate from a very different position than the Biden people. The Biden team sought to appease the Iranians, basically to buy their way back to the negotiating table. They lifted sanctions, they gave them billions of dollars. I think the President Trump wants to bring the Iranians to their knees, so they'll crawl back to the negotiating table and they'll beg for a deal. And that deal, I would hope, would call not just for limiting or put time limits on the Iranian nuclear program, but for the first time, will actually dismantle Iran's nuclear program.
President Trump, in the campaign, he presented himself as the anti-war candidate. Let's end these wars. No new wars, no foreign wars. But he also is very good at economic warfare, very much into that, the tariffs and such. And do you expect maximum pressure again? I think that's the message coming out of his transition team. They're going to revive that
Definitely.
policy in order to get a much better deal with Iran.
Definitely. I do foresee that. And I think also President Biden, and strangely enough, in contrast to President Obama used to say all options are on the table, including a military option. And then President Biden took the military option off the table. They would say all options are on the table. We would never say military option. I think the military option is going to be back on the table.
Good.
That would be my, that's my prediction.
Have you sensed or assessed some immediate impact of Trump's victory on the Lebanese front, the war between Israel and Hezbollah? Because it does look like the talks for a ceasefire are further along than the efforts in Gaza, which have been going on for a year.
I think they are. I think the Lebanese know that they have 2 months of an administration that's trying to hold Israel back. And I think that President Trump will understand quite rightly that the way to end this war quickly is not to hold Israel back, but to let Israel use its full force. And so now they're trying to get in under the wire, the Lebanese, by saying, okay, we want to have a ceasefire now. I don't know if they're going to meet Israel's fundamental request and its condition. That is that Israel will be able to intervene again militarily in southern Lebanon should Hezbollah try to redeploy there and south of the Tani River. So far, they're saying it's a violation of Lebanese sovereignty, which I find rather funny because there is no Lebanese sovereignty. Lebanese sovereignty is an oxymoron. Now, Lebanon is basically a colony of Iran. It has no sovereignty. And so, I mean, if I had my druthers, and I know on in this webinar, I could say the word druthers, and you understand me. Israelis would never understand that word. If I had my druthers, I simply would declare all of southern Lebanon, south of the Litani, a no-go zone. It would be a DMZ, and we wouldn't have to worry about intervening there because nobody would be able to set foot there except for the Israeli army.
Yeah. It seems, in my sense is that Hezbollah is more interested in a ceasefire now, not just because of Trump, but because they are getting so weakened. I think Defense Minister Gallant, before he was removed from office, he said Israel's destroyed 80% of their long-range rockets. They are getting weakened to a point where the Christian and Sunni Arabs in Lebanon who are oppose Hezbollah and Iran's grip, that Hezbollah may be afraid they're losing that stranglehold over Lebanese affairs. Do you see any indications of that?
I do, I do. And it's not just the Christians and the Druze and the Sunnis have had it with the fact that Hezbollah, acting on Iranian interests, has dragged Lebanon into this war and brought tremendous destruction into Lebanon. For what? For what? Because they're supporting Hamas? You think the Druze care about Hamas? Christians care about Hamas? No, it's also Iran, David. Iran invested countless billions of dollars in these proxies. It's lost one of them ready. It needs the Hezbollah proxy. Hezbollah is the main proxy because Hezbollah guards the route, what we call the Shiite crescent, that extends from Tehran to the Mediterranean. And if Iran loses Lebanon, it'll not only probably lose Lebanon, it'll lose Syria as well. And Iran will be back in 1979 or thereabouts. They'll still be in Iraq and in Yemen. But it'll be a tremendous blow. So Iran is basically saying, okay, we'll pay a price. We'll implement 1701. Hezbollah will withdraw north of the Litani for the time being. We'll go back, but we'll preserve Hezbollah and we'll rearm, we'll regroup, we'll draw the lessons of this war, and we'll remain the major force in Lebanon, and we will remain the anchor of that Shiite crescent.
It seems like different calculations than Hamas in Gaza. They've been battered and lost 90% of their weapons and rockets and so much of their army. But there's still no one besides the IDF to take their place in Gaza. But in Lebanon, you have a Lebanese army, you have a large part of the population that would be happy to get rid of Hezbollah. And they seem to be much more open and brazen in expressing this and mocking Hezbollah on in social media. So is it ripening? Are we nearing a tipping point?
Keep in mind, all these ethnic groups are heavily armed. And if they sense that Hezbollah's gotten weakened, and certainly they don't love Hezbollah, I think that's an understatement, they'll turn their weapons on them. They'll turn their weapons on them.
But it's a frightful thing because they faced a civil war for 15 years And no one really wants that, none of these sides. But what we need is to pray for another velvet revolution in Lebanon.
Indeed.
Yeah, it happened with the Syrians after the assassination of Hariri, Rafik Hariri. The pressure, international pressure, built up on the Syrians to get out of Lebanon, and they did it.
Right.
Is that possible again with Hezbollah and Iran?
But Keith, not that, because Hezbollah is actually an indigenous group as well. It's not that it's acting on the orders of a foreign power, but it's Shiites, and Shiites became the largest single minority in Lebanon. Yeah. And under the old system of what they call confessional divisions of Lebanese power, they got the smallest piece of the pie. Because when that was done, there weren't that many Shiites, but the Shiites had a higher birth rate, certainly higher than the Christians, because Lebanon was created as a Christian country. Mm-hmm. And now Christians are, along with the Druze, a minority. So no, you can't evict all the Shiites, but you can evict Hezbollah as an idea, certainly, and you can evict Iran as an imperial power.
Yes, yeah, okay. And do you think the war in Gaza, has the Trump election had any impact there? The hostage talks, the weakening of Hamas. Have you seen anything even before Trump takes office that might indicate a shift?
Not yet. But I'd love to see, though, I must tell you, is that that President Trump will do what President Biden didn't dare to do and say to the Qataris, you have 24 hours to get those hostages back, or I'm going to put you on the list of states who support terror. And you won't be able to do business anywhere in the world. I'm going to cut down your SWIFT accounts. I'm going to close all the branches of Qatari universities in America. I'm going to cut off the branches of American universities in Doha. Mm-hmm. And they can do the same thing to the Turks. The Turks are big supporters. Mm-hmm. And putting that maximum pressure on Iran, you get those hostages back. America has tremendous numbers of tools in its tool chest that have not been used yet. Mm-hmm. And it's extraordinary, given the number of Americans who were killed on October 7th and the Americans who were taken hostage.
There are two wild cards in all this analysis we're trying to do. One is Turkey and the other is Russia, because whether Israel likes it or not, this is a proxy war between the West and the Russia-Iran axis. And Turkey seems to want to have a foot in both camps, and the direction they're going is very troubling. Can you comment on that?
Well, it's great. Turkey, Erdogan, the president, is a big supporter of Hamas. He's basically the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And yes, he has a foot literally on either side of the Bosphorus. One foot is in NATO in Europe, and the other foot is buying weapons from the Russians and taking on NATO. And the only reason the world puts up with this is because of geography. The Turks happen to be astride this essential waterway, and it's going back, to the Crimean War of the 1850s. It's always been a flashpoint, and so Erdogan can behave appallingly and not really pay much of a price for it with the West. So he's less vulnerable than the Qataris are, but this is certainly a proxy war. Reports coming out of Lebanon now show that Israeli troops have found a massive amounts of advanced Russian weaponry, in the tunnels. And we've now seen how the Russians have been involved in providing air defenses for the Iranians. They've been given that missile technology has made its way from Russia through Iran to the Houthi rebels, and they've fired these rockets at us. This is certainly a proxy war between American and Western arms and Russian arms, and various versions of Russian arms that come through it by way of North Korea, for example. The Iranian Shahab rockets that they fired at us, in April and October were knockoffs of a North Korean rocket, which were knockoffs of a Russian rocket. Okay, so it is a proxy war, as have been many Arab-Israeli wars before this. And it is astonishing to me that people don't realize this sufficiently in Washington, that at stake here is not whether Israel is taking sufficient precautions in battling Hamas in Gaza or, battling Hezbollah in Beirut, but the fact that America is in a cold war And that Cold War is American arms against Soviet arms. It's the F-15s, F-16s, and F-35s against the S-300 and S-400 Russian anti-aircraft systems. It's so many issues. And even on a purely financial level, David, I mean, after the Israeli Air Force blew up four S-300 systems in Iran, who's going to buy that in the world today? Would you buy a used anti-aircraft system from the Russians today? But you're sure as heck going to buy an F-35. I'm going to get me one of those. And right. And so just in terms of, economy, finances, a young Israeli pilot told me, 25 years old, told me this months ago that he had acquired more combat hours than all other combat fighter pilots in the world combined. Combined.
In the
And those are that those
F-35.
hours are on American jets made in Fort Worth, Texas, where I imagine you have some viewers.
Yes.
So thank you, Fort Worth.
Yeah, there's stealth, this stealth technology in the latest
Yeah.
Western next generation fighters has proven it can that Russia and its allies are completely naked. They're, no matter even the S-400 probably can't protect them. So air superiority. Ron Dermer, strategic affairs minister and probably closest advisor to Prime Minister Netanyahu, reports are he was just in Moscow before he went to the U.S. to talk about Lebanon and other matters. What was he doing there? Do you know?
Getting the Russians on board, and the Russians are players. They have troops in Syria. They obviously have an arms supplier to Iran and to Hezbollah, and so they can weigh in. They're also, Russian citizens who are hostages in Gaza.
Yes. And there was talk that they'd give priority to getting them out first, like a separate mini deal first. I think another big question for Israelis and for Christians who stand with Israel, the Trump election, is it going to make any impact before he enters office on the hostages and their fate?
I don't know. I would hope so. I think the big problem there is that nobody knows quite who's in charge, who's calling the shots with Hamas. Extremely torturous, painful, agonizing situation. Agonizing
Yes.
situation.
Yes. I see your yellow ribbon, my friend. We'll
Oh
have
yeah,
to
sure. Don't leave home without it.
stand with
Only
him
hope.
every
Yeah.
day. And we just appreciate your time here. Any closing comments about between now and Trump taking office in January 20th? There's laws in the U.S. now that incoming president can't really make foreign policy and make deals before he's sworn in, but there's awful temptation for him to get involved here in a substantive way.
Well, the way President Obama did in December, the last before he was sworn, before he left office, and they passed a terrible resolution in the Security Council 2334 that condemned Israel's communities, our settlements in Judea and Samaria. Now the big question in the UN is whether the Security Council will recognize the Palestinian state and what that means for us.
Before
That means every
Biden
time
leaves
our army,
office.
before Biden leaves office, yeah, we don't know if that's happening or not. I've written about this week in the Hebrew press here, that we have to prepare for that possibility. I mean, Joe Biden is not Barack Obama, and I know him well, and he describes himself as a Zionist. He's a Zionist. Depth of his resentments, or because we lost the election. This is what the AOC was saying the other day. And we don't know. We don't know. We have to be prepared. That's our duty. I would just say to your viewers and listeners this, that what has transpired here over the last year and now 2 months is a war for civilizations. It's not a war between Israel and Hamas or Israel and Hezbollah or even Israel and Iran. It is a war between the civilization and the values that we all cherish and their opposite. I know that your audience believes in the existence of evil in the world. Not everybody does. But what we are fighting against here is pure, unadulterated, violent, barbarous evil. Evil. And our victory here will be your victory everywhere. I for your support in this victory against evil in our times. I say this as an Israeli, as a father and a grandfather. We say Toda Rabba, thank you very much for everything you've done.
Point well taken, and we're standing with you, Michael, and the Jewish nation and people. We want to thank you for your time, Dr. Michael B. Oren, former Israeli ambassador to Washington, and we just really appreciate your insights here into this relationship. You think you're the new ambassador, Yehiel Leiter, he's going to do a good job? You know him well?
Oh, yeah. He's a terrific, a good guy. I've spoken to him. Very good. Very good. And, you know, he doesn't enter at an easy time either. It's never an easy ride. It's a rodeo in many ways. But there's no job that, from my mind, that has a greater honor and fulfillment.
Yeah.
But again, bless you all.
Yes, thank you. You took the portfolio at a very difficult time under the Obama administration and did a stellar job. And we all appreciate that, and that you're still in here fighting
blessing
and
for me.
Helping
I
shed
am.
Light. Okay. All right. That's
the
our
Israel
time.
Advocacy Group. That's what we do. We advocate. Thank
Israel
you very much.
Advocacy Group and Substack Clarity. Okay. That's our time for now. We thank Michael Oren for being with us. Join us next week, Thursday, 3 p.m. in the afternoon Israel time for our ICJ webinar series. God bless you from Jerusalem.